Hello world, this is the Know Your Place podcast, episode 66. On this week's episode, Luke from British Columbia joins me to talk about the coronavirus. Stay tuned. Started. It sent. Okay, we're live. Welcome to the Know Your Place podcast. I'm Charles Altendorf, and this is episode 66, where we're going to talk about the Rona. So, on this week's episode, I have Luke with me from British Columbia. Say hello to the fans, Luke.
Hello, welcome. Nice to meet you all. Hope you're having a great day.
Yeah, and so I brought Luke on today because we sort of wanted to talk about the coronavirus and how it's been impacting and affecting our different areas and how sort of compare and contrast. So with that, I'll sort of get to the introduction part and let Luke sort of go first. Luke, tell us about sort of a brief introduction on British Columbia and sort of, I guess, how you heard about it and how it started to creep into your daily life.
Well, here in British Columbia, we've got a very strong connection to East Asia. So generally speaking, as far back as early January, there's been discussions about the viral epidemic in China because there was a lot of connections and a lot of flights in between here and China. So a lot of people were already on edge from January, but most people at the time had still treated it as more or less just a relatively mild, like, viral infection that was unlikely to do much damage to the economy or to people's health. So most people were pretty lax about it. But there were people that were concerned. And so we saw that there was a rise in racism and a rise in attacks on the local Chinese community. And a lot of, like, Chinese restaurants saw their business tank, but that was among the first things that we noticed. I think we actually had our first cases in BC actually in late January, officially anyway. I'm going to get you the actual date here. BC first case. January 29th was when the first case in BC had been recorded. The cultural attitude of BC is generally speaking pretty lax, I think, on this. And had been pretty lax until about March. In March, around the beginning of it, when the World Health Organization declared that this would be a pandemic, a lot of people started to get really worried. And the government immediately started to enact policies to restrict movement and to try to limit the spread of the virus. Which generally what they tried to do was things that involved bringing in social distancing policies, etc. But I think before I get into that, I'll let you discuss Kentucky first.
Okay, yeah. So, no, that was a great intro and sort of leads into sort of what I was going to talk about, too. So in Kentucky, like you said, sort of nationally, you know, obviously we also have a deep connection to East China, but sort of a more West Coast thing, right? You know, it's not as prevalent here in Kentucky. Believe it or not, Kentucky actually has a deep connection with Japan because we do a lot of business with them with Toyota. But I like you, sort of noticed that it was taking place outside of America in January. But again, you know, being in Kentucky, sort of really far inland, I guess I never really expected sort of an outbreak here, right? You know, because when Ebola happened and swine flu happened, it didn't really happen here, you know. So it was sort of interesting to hear the threat. But the tipping point really, so I guess when I started noticing things, you know, they were getting really nervous about the NBA and March Madness was coming up, of course. And I think we'll talk about this later, but you used to work for a bar, so I'm sure that was sort of something weighing on the mind of management. But I noticed the first case that was confirmed here was late February, and it was someone who ended up getting out that they had come over from Italy. So when the outbreak happened in Italy, that was when the first person came over here, and they actually supposedly spread it to 6 other people at a choir practice in one of our counties at church. So before then, we didn't have any confirmed cases in the urban areas, which I think is kind of interesting and different than sort of how it broke out other places.
I'm not entirely surprised by that, because it seems to me that Kentucky is a little bit more isolated than a lot of the other places that were hit particularly hard. For example, it's likely that in Kentucky, it's more likely that people who visit Kentucky are more likely to be in the States already rather than people from international travel. That may be wrong. I may be wrong. I shouldn't speak for Kentucky. I apologize if I'm overextending my bounds here.
Actually, I mean, yeah, that is how it is typically in the winter months. I would say sometimes in the summer we get more international travel, typically from Canada, but we don't. That is the most international travel I generally see here is from Canada. So you're right. It is a sort of isolated thing. That's the main reason why I was so shocked it ended up actually eventually coming here in general.
That's one of the reasons I was so shocked that it wasn't as bad here in BC as they were projecting. I was expecting we were going to be one of the worst hit, and when in Seattle, Washington, just next door, started to see the first cases earlier in early March. I was under the impression that BC was on the verge of doing the exact same thing, but somehow that didn't occur. But before I get into that, what I will say is that here in BC, before we enacted our lockdown, we didn't actually enact a lockdown. We were very lax on our policies. We didn't bring any policies that really limited freedom as much as the US did. All that we really did was bring in a 2-meter social distancing policy that was in order, but it wasn't really policed much. So if you didn't follow the 2-meter social distancing, which I guess is 6 feet in the US. So if you didn't follow the 2-meter social distancing order, they generally didn't do anything. Most people just did because when the government told people that they should do this, and when the health authorities explained the threat, people generally listened. So generally what happened was around 100% of people were going about their early day-to-day lives in the beginning of March. And by the end of March, that was down to 30% of normal activity.
Yeah. I think that is a good thing that y'all did. And, we'll go into this later, but yeah, I'll explain to more about the US situation in a minute.
I think one thing I will say is that I, in particular, am one of the ones that was a casualty of the virus in terms of losing a job. And so because my job that I work in is I work in a restaurant right next to the stadiums where they have all the large events. So whether they are sports events or something along the lines of, say, a concert, or what the event that was occurring at the time right before the lockdown was something called Rugby Sevens. And there was a lot of people going everywhere around there. And literally right after Rugby Sevens ended, around the 7th of March is when that the World Health Organization called this a pandemic. And literally within 5 days, BC was essentially going into lockdown. We got really lucky because we did all this before the risk of before spring break, because in spring break in BC we get 2 weeks for the kids, and it happens later in March instead of earlier. So there wasn't very much travel outside of BC prior to the pandemic call, so we didn't have as much spread as we would have imagined.
Right. Yeah, in Kentucky, and sort of, I guess everybody, of course, notices, and it's very on blatant display, right, that there was no sort of national, there are CDC guidelines, of course, and there was certain calls for certain things nationally, right, but a uniform plan obviously didn't happen, and in some ways it didn't happen in Canada either. But the biggest thing that I think I noticed with the U.S. response that is worrying, and in particular happened here, to a really bad degree, was it was like they flipped a switch off overnight. Like, you were open one day, and then the governor said that your business was going to be shut down 2 days later for an indefinite amount of time.
Oh, yeah, they did the same thing here. Most people actually were getting laid off from their jobs before the government actually put in the policy to restrict restaurants from having sit-downs. Most places actually stayed open here, so we were kind of lucky, but the unemployment rate still spiked to well over, I believe it spiked to about 13% at the worst period, 13 to 13.4%. About 300,000 jobs were lost in the province, which might not sound like much, but there's only about 5.2 million people that live here. And so 300,000 jobs were lost, and it was looking like a serious, real big concern. If not for the government enacting some stimulus programs that I personally have benefited from, most of my coworkers and peers would have wound up likely on the streets. So it's definitely been a very uncomfortable and concerning time period for all of us. It's been tough, is all I'll say, and it's had a negative impact on all of our mental health.
Well, and as I've sent to you before, but here it was even much, much worse because they decided to cut, you know, our governor phrased it as only retaining life-sustaining business. And in that process, they picked so many winners and losers. And I guess I should be grateful because they did some worse things in other states like Michigan and California. But, I mean, you know, they didn't let people cut hair. They didn't let people do all these different things. And at one point, 45% of our population filed for unemployment. So,
I think it was similar, about like 20 to 25% of workers in Canada did the same thing. Like 8 million Canadians were collecting what we call the Canada Emergency Response Benefit, or as Canadians in the media have called it, the CERB. And you can make a lot of jokes about how it sounds like Serbian, you know, my friend makes a lot of jokes about that. But anyway, so they call it the CERB, and it gives about $2,000 Canadian, so about $1,600 US per month. About $500 per week. But they give you it in a $2,000 check every 4 weeks.
And I don't have a problem with the UBI. And of course we did this, we had a national stimulus, which actually was good and did help a lot of people. But the problem was, is that on the state level, our unemployment system was broken before this happened. And they did not fix it, and it's still awful, and there's still people who have not received their money from it.
See, and that's the thing, is because in Canada, the system we have is also broken. See, it's called the employment insurance system. Right. It's similar to your unemployment, but it's equally as difficult to apply and get approved for, and it can take up to weeks. And that's why the Canadian government brought in the CERB instead, because it was so much easier to administer, and you apply, you get approved, guaranteed. Basically, it solved and prevented a lot of people falling through the cracks that it looks like in the U.S., the systems that they enacted have not done the same thing.
I think they were kind of working for a bit, but, you know, because it's been politicized, right, and there's tugging back and forth from both parties now, and there's no plan of how long it was going to go into place, that's, of course, caused it to break. Which, that's typical American politics, I'm sure you're aware. But, you know, in the beginning, yeah, it was working in the first month, I'd say. But it just, you know, again, they fought over it, they politicized it. And then the worst thing I think that was the most disingenuous was they kept putting out these articles claiming all these people that all this money went out to people that were supposedly dead. And
I heard about that.
Yeah, and I mean, sure, I'm sure some did, but like, okay, so then that's an excuse to not extend what you said you were going to do. I mean, you know, people are out of work and our state unemployment programs are all broken. So, you know, it's playing politics is classic America. But what I wanted to sort of say was the problem I had with the way the governor in our state in particular did things was it was like a switch was flipped overnight. And I understand that must have happened in a lot of places, but it really seemed like it was quick here. Like, it was from one day open to one day shut. And unfortunately, the Kentucky economy is not based enough in manufacturing, is based a lot in service sector, and they closed most of the service sector. And I don't know. While some places I've seen in America look like they're starting to recover some, I think it's going to be a really long time before we do.
I think a lot of people have been comparing what's been going on around the world and the different things that countries have done to try and combat this. And they've often pointed to Sweden, and they've looked at Sweden right. And said, well, Sweden didn't go into a lockdown, and look what happened there. And it's true that Sweden has had more deaths than Norway and Finland, and has right. had much more cases as well, and that they haven't really flattened the curve as easily. But a lot of people have made the argument and said, well, was it worth it? And to be fair, I'm not entirely sure what I feel on this anymore, because Sweden didn't go into a lockdown, but their signs are still showing their economy is suffering just as much as everyone else. And so I don't know if this can really be blamed on the government as much as it can be blamed on businesses being scared themselves. In BC's case, we kind of did a bit of a hybrid. I would say that in North America, we had one of the least strict measures on this. Mm-hmm. And yet, despite having the least strict, closest to Sweden's response measures in North America, we've had the least cases and the lowest deaths per capita.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the big thing that I'm starting to take away from this, which is going to make a lot of people unhappy, is, I shouldn't say unhappy, but I think people have a tough time coping with, is that there may not have been necessarily a right response. You know, it's a pandemic, right?
Well, so we've never done this before. We don't know what right. we're doing.
Right, so... So I think that, and that's a great thing you bring up there. You know, we don't know that, you know, because there are staunch pro. I don't really consider myself a staunch pro Sweden either. You know, right? I'm kind of just like, I don't know what really works. You know, all I know is that, you know, it seems kind of insane here that they continued on so long with stuff, and now they keep threatening to reshut stuff down here. And it just doesn't seem like it's a good idea, and it just seems like they need to... I don't really know. I don't know what's going to do anything, right? Because... and we'll get into the data sort of here in a second, since we're sort of moving on to the next part of where I wanted to go with this subject. But yeah, so basically, you know, I noticed again that, you know... And the biggest thing to me was, like, what they did scared people, right? I mean, they had that basketball player test positive, then they closed the NBA, and then... The March Madness one was really awful. So they're doing one conference tournament. It was the last one still going on that Friday. I think it was like the 20th or something in the Big East tournament. And they stopped it mid-game, which that's just bizarre. I don't know what they were thinking. All the teams had already been bussed in there, right? And the team was still playing, right? But for somehow that was they needed to shut it down right then at the half. It didn't make any sense at all. There weren't even any fans there.
When they announced the NBA player that came down and announced that they were shutting down all the sporting events, I was actually at work. And since we're very dependent on sports, that was around the point where I realized, I'm going to lose my job, aren't I? And then
pretty much, yeah.
Literally a week later, I was unemployed. And I was like, okay. I didn't know what to expect at that point. It's like, oh, go.
Yeah, that's wild. So I don't, you know, I guess for me, you know, the question really comes down to economics runs on a bit of certainty. So at some point you have to figure out what level of certainty you as a country are a country or a state or a municipality is comfortable with. And what makes me nervous is when I start hearing governors and people on TV keep saying it's a fluid situation. Because in some ways, yes, it is a fluid situation, but in other ways, it's as fluid as you want to make it out to be, right? You know.
Well, yeah, I think part of the problem is that during this entire time that this virus has been spreading, we haven't known much about it. And so a lot of our reactions to it have been based on older data that has now been found out to be not quite as accurate as we thought. Like the Imperial College report was based on a mortality figure of 2%. And so the millions of deaths that they projected was based on 2% of all those who were infected dying, we now know that the mortality figures are likely to be closer to anywhere between 0.2 and 0.6%, which is still pretty high. I'm not going to lie. That is not something to sneeze about.
Oh, man. That was bad.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's not as bad as we initially thought. So the numbers of deaths are going to be obviously much lower, and they've turned out that way. But in saying that, I think the one thing that we need to be cautious of, and where I've kind of taken a bit of a read roll back my opinion on this, because I was of the opinion for a long time that this was basically blown way out of proportion and that it was a nothing burger. And I still think it was blown out of proportion. But I think that people are losing the forest for the trees when they're only focusing on the mortality figures. They're not focusing on any of the other health effects that seem to be negative. For example, there's evidence that it can harm the brain and lead to brain disorders and mental cognitive decline. There's evidence that those who survive might have a shorter life expectancy. And there's evidence that that it can lead to permanent long-term decreases in your lung capacity. And so these are all things that are actually quite concerning. And I think that the focus should instead be on trying to be aware of those effects rather than just the outright fatality numbers. So when it comes to trusting the numbers or trusting the data, I do trust it to a degree, but I think that to a large extent, there has been a lot of worst case scenario planning that has been engaged with in the last 5 months with regards to the worst thing that could possibly happen, which is 2.5 to 5 million American deaths.
I think the thing that bothers me with that, and I'm willing to accept, you know, we don't know what type of long-term health consequences will result from this virus, and I'm not sure we will know for a few more months or even years. But the thing that I think I found the most disturbing in this was, again, you know, it's this thing where I'm being forced, like, to take an all-or-nothing stance, right? Like, I'm being forced to accept that this is so bad that I have to be locked down in my house, essentially, with my children for however long until they think that they can totally eradicate that, which I think, by the way, is really foolhardy. But then, on the other end of the spectrum, you got people out there who don't want to take any precautions or safety whatsoever, right? And that's classic America that I get forced into all the time, is where I'm somebody who's actually relatively pragmatic, and I find myself being tugged in both directions all the time. Like, you know, I've heard people say that this is some kind of democratic conspiracy, right? And then conversely, I hear people say that, oh, this is something that would have been handled if the Republicans would just enact tomorrow some bill to pay for everyone to stay home, as if that's possible too. And it's,
well,
just
it's not financially feasible for long term. Like, for right. The long term, it's not feasible.
Right.
I do think that I have been kind of a little annoyed, especially with a lot of states in the U.S.'s approach, which is basically where they legislate people have to do things. What I like about BC's response is it's basically been very mature, and it's been respectful of people's intelligence. So it's basically saying, please stay home, please stay safe, but if you don't, we're not going to punish you. You're not getting in trouble. We're not telling businesses to shut down. We were just saying that they need to be mindful, and that if you're working in a restaurant, restaurants can't have the kitchen area, or not the kitchen area, the indoor serving area open because right. of the risk of spread. Like, those are things that I can understand and I can get. And at least when it comes to BC, we were more mature about it. And the government here seemed to trust the people more than I think a lot of US states did.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the most telling things I saw very early on was I watched this clip where the Los Angeles mayor went on TV and was like, I know 99% of you are complying with our orders, but we're going to find that last percent and hunt you down. And I just found that completely disturbing.
Well, the thing I find that's completely annoying about that, and what scares me, is that we know you only need 80% compliance in order to actually crush the curve. So, like, for example, in BC, I don't think it ever really exceeded 80%. There was always about 20% of the people that were like, fuck this, this is non... Sorry, right. I probably shouldn't swear.
One probably like, won't get me revoked.
They were like, yeah, to heck with this. I want nothing to do with this. This is dumb. I just want to live my life. There's always people like that. But you only need about like 80% compliance. So to hear like the Los Angeles mayor say, 1% of you are not following orders and we're going to hunt you down. The thing that just upsets me and bugs me, because when you politicize it that way, you cause a major reaction where people are like, well, I don't want to listen to what you're doing. You're making a demand. See, and that's a major difference between how BC did it, which is we just want you to stay home and stay safe if you can. Please be mindful, wash your hands, wear a mask if you feel you need to. It's been very like mature. And so people here have been listening and following the directions because it's not a demand. If the premier or the prime minister went on TV and says, stay home or we will hunt you down, then all of a sudden you'd probably have a huge amount of people that don't like that politician in general, which are going to be like, well, to heck with you. We're not going to stay home. We're not going to risk. We'd rather have you try and hunt us down, because how dare you restrict our freedom? And see, and that's right. What happens when you politicize it. You lead to a major backlash, and that's what's happening in the United States.
Right, and I'm so glad you put it that way, because that is exactly what's happening, right? Like, even here in Kentucky, for example, I think early on people really didn't have much of a problem with what the governor was doing, right? But then he himself started getting on TV and saying, well, screw anybody who's mad that they're not getting their unemployment, or screw all these small business owners that are upset, right? And, you know, roped off the Capitol for a day or two, and there were snipers on the roof and all this kind of stuff, right? And it's never a de-escalation, right? Yeah. It's always an escalation. So now we've gotten to the point this weekend, right, where they instituted a rule that we're supposed to be wearing masks when we're inside a business, right? Like, legally. But then he's also at the same time under a restraining order from a federal judge saying he can't make any more executive orders. So nobody really knows what the law is right now. And
yeah.
That's absolutely scary. I mean, if you want to talk about something that feels Orwellian, that almost feels Orwellian, when you don't know what the law is and you could go outside and meet the wrong person and get arrested or shot or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing that I just find really scary about this, and what really worries me, is not actually that the governments are enacting these policies. That was to be expected. What worries me is that people are kind of emotional and irrational. And they're also usually quite partisan and believe in their ability to do whatever the heck they want without any restrictions. And so when a politician tells them they can't do something, or even when a business tells them they can't do something, most people get upset. This is why, for example, when Costco said that you needed to wear a mask, and then people would come in and say, no, this is America, I don't have to do that. But realistically, I mean, a business can do whatever the heck they want. That has nothing to do with the government. So that's a completely different story. But you still had people that were equally as upset by it, because they don't like having something that is an inconvenience being forced on them. A lot of people I know wear a mask every day just because they want to be safe. Like, I do it. For example, if I go out, I'm not going to go anywhere without a mask just because I feel safer and more comfortable with it. But the reality is, I don't think it should be forced or legally mandated, because that's going to do the opposite of what it's meant to do. In fact, I actually have a very interesting thing that the chief health I can't remember what it's called, but Dr. Bonnie Henry is not a government health minister, but she is. She works for the government as one of our leading like health leaders. Anyway, so she said this. This was quoted. So this guy named Richard Zussman is the parliamentary legislature reporter for the Global BC, which is a local news company. And this is what he said. So this is the clearest explanation from Dr. Bonnie Henry on why not to close restaurants, bars, and hotels due to recent outbreaks. And this is what she said. Shutting things down just drives them underground.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
This is BC's response. And this is why we've handled this so well. Because we And our leaders seem to understand that just forcing people to do things doesn't work because it leads to a pushback. The government here gets that.
And I find that particularly bizarre, but granted, the state that I'm originally from, Wisconsin, has taken more of a BC approach. And, you know, their economy isn't as crashed as the one is here in Kentucky. But it's like, I can't believe I'm in a state where people are all hot and proud about, you know, being in the mountains or whatever and being their own type of people. But then they elect these leaders who seem to embody the absolute opposite of that, right? You know, we're going to tell people what to do, you know, and it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. I don't know what's going to happen now, you know, with this lawsuit stuff. It keeps going back and forth in the courts, and I have no idea what's going to happen, but it definitely seems like the rhetoric's not being toned down. So it's going to turn into R&D thing.
One of the things that we should discuss is, for example, do you think we should continue these measures?
I agree with more of the approach that it should be sort of your personal decision. You take the risk type of deal. Now, I know some people are say, you know, well, if you don't wear a mask and you go inside and you sneeze on me, then, you know, you've taken the decision for me. So
I think that there is an argument that could be made for that. But I'm very interested on trying to find the right balance because I'm pragmatic. I mean, I know that you and I have very different political views. I'm quite to the left and you're quite libertarian minded. So obviously we're quite different on that. But the one thing I will agree with libertarians on is I do not like the restriction on personal liberties. The less restrictions on personal liberties, the better. So I want to find a balance on this between protecting public health and assuring people have the right to make decisions without restrictions.
I mean, if it were really the balance I would really see there is, you know, some businesses want to make people wear masks come in, they can. And if other ones don't want to be held liable, then, you know, I guess you could make somebody sign a waiver. You know,
I think one thing they could do is maybe they could put a policy in place for things where, you know, people can't really avoid, like maybe a grocery store, maybe have a mask order for those, but not for something like, say, your local Best Buy, because that's not essential. People need to buy groceries. So if they need to buy groceries, then it should be pretty much assured that if they go to a grocery store, that it should be as safe as possible. So I think that that's an example of where wearing a mask and having sanitizer on you at all times should be a requirement. But when it comes to, say, something like going to your local Best Buy or going to a bar or something like that, you personally, by going there, are taking the risk. And so that's different to me because neither of those things are considered to be essential in the way that food or groceries or
for example, the German restaurant that I go to here, it recently expanded immensely, so its dining room is huge, so it's very easy to stay 6 feet apart from somebody who's not in your party. So, you know, it's kind of interesting they were put under the same type of restrictions. Now granted, when I was going in there, they weren't requiring masks, but, you know, obviously with this new law, the new law states that now, if it's enforced, again, I don't know exactly whether or not it's enforced. That's totally, it's totally up in the air, but I think most people are complying. Right now, what it is, like today, I went and ate at a restaurant with my coworker because I haven't seen him in ages because we're not allowed to be in the office. So what they did is you order your food, you wear the mask, and then you sit down, you can take it off. So, you know, the main thing for me that I was having a problem with, because I don't care if you're a private establishment and you want to make rules. I don't have a problem with that at all. You're a private establishment. You know, the main issue I had was there were people saying that I should be wearing a mask when I'm outside. Right, or like when I'm at the park.
And the thing that's annoying about that is that doesn't really do anything because as we now know, the virus does not spread very well in outside. So wearing a mask outside isn't really helping much. It's more of a it's extra cautious when you don't need to be.
Right.
Is what it is.
And that's what but this is classic what's wrong with America and why I ended up joining the libertarian movement is because What always happens here is I never see people want to have less rules. They're always like, well, I feel this way, so therefore I want to restrict the rights of my neighbor, right? And I think people would say, oh, well, I don't really believe that. But it's like, well, you vote for it, though. You always vote for it, you know? And that's just it's getting crazy, you know? And this, unfortunately, that's what ended up happening with this health crisis. And I think that's why I don't really know whether or not we could have avoided the percentages we have just because of all the international travel we have anyway. But, you know, that's why we're seeing sort of economic and sort of social unrest, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, is because of that. It's absolutely because of that. And, you know, now I got to look through feeds and see people that literally say, these Republicans killed my grandma, or these Democrats destroyed my business. And, you know, that's just unhelpful.
Like, it's totally not helpful because you're politicizing it and you're turning it into a partisan issue. I mean, look, I'm going to say something. You may or may not agree with it, but it's the one thing I will say on this. I personally want to keep the Canada-US border closed indefinitely until we know that the US can manage to get this under control. And I say this because in Canada, we've managed to lower the number of cases per day to a manageable sub 400 every day. And the US is adding as much as 65,000 a day. And I know that like the numbers are kind of questionable in some cases. I know you personally disagree with some of the death statistics, so I'm not going to get into that too much. But like with regards to keeping some restrictions in place, for the most part in BC, there hasn't really been all that many restrictions in place. So for example, we don't actually have restrictions on eating out or anything other than most places still have social distancing policies. It feels like for the most part, things are back to normal the way they were back in, say, February. But in saying that, I do think that there are certain things that should always stay in place. I want to keep social distancing in place as long as possible. I'd like to keep the border closed until I'm certain that the United States has managed to combat this viral epidemic to the same degree that Canada has. And I think lastly, I would still put a restriction on any large events of over, say, about 100 people, because it's very difficult for that amount of people in a space to socially distance. I think I would make exceptions for outdoor festivals with some strong like cautious recommendations. Like, you go to one of these events, you put yourself at risk type deal, where basically we're not going to ban them, but if you go here, you have to go, when you go home, you have to go in social, you have to isolate for at least 4 days to see if you notice anything. And if you feel sick or anything like that, you need to immediately contact a public health official. Or in another situation, anyone that goes to these types of events would have to put themselves on a way to be easily contacted just in case someone there it does come down with the virus. So for example, some restaurants here will require you to put your email or your phone number when you order, so that if they ever do find someone that was there that was sick or something, then they can contact you and let you know. I think that that is a fair compromise. And it's not really quite a restriction on liberty, because you still can choose to go to an event like that and you give your number in that situation. Because I think that that is a fair thing to have as a restriction. Because I think that I really don't think that we're going to be able to vaccinate against this virus and ever get rid of it entirely. I think we're going to have to live with it. I think it's going to become endemic. Some of my friends, some who you may know, I'm not going to mention their name in here because
confidentiality reasons.
For example, some of my friends think that there's going to be a vaccine literally within months, and that this is going to be something that you just vaccinate every year, like a virus, like the flu. And I'm not saying that that won't happen. I'm just saying that there is evidence that are showing that the immunity only lasts 2 or 3 months. And if the immunity only lasts 2 or 3 months, that will not be feasible. Couple that with the realization that as much as 25% of people say they refuse to get vaccinated, meaning that a vaccine will not really work. So,
well, and I'd also like to add to that vaccine thing. This is where I'm going to get sort of crazy, but it is my podcast, right? So I'm allowed to say what I want.
Yeah, obviously. And I can completely disagree, but I'll let you say what you want first.
we don't know for certain that I don't know how to put this properly. There are people in the pharmaceutical industry that I would say are vested in the vaccine being the solution. Not to say that it's not going to be a solution and that it could well be a solution, but I would say there are people, especially in America, that are very invested in it being the only solution, if that makes sense. And yeah. I want to also point out, you can't sue in America if a vaccine injures you. So yeah, these people are going to be guinea pigs, you know?
Well, I'm not going to, when or if they do release a vaccine, I'm not going to be among the first persons to sign up for it. I'm going to wait at least 3 months to see how it turns out. I completely trust vaccines. I'm not anti-vaccine at all. And I have no reason to not trust it. But due to the speed that they have been developing this vaccine, I am definitely concerned that they will rush it. And I don't want to risk my health by getting it too early. If that makes sense.
And we've already seen from tests that a lot of these tests have had problems because they've rushed them. So, you know, you're absolutely right with that concern. And I just want to point out, I haven't not vaccinated my children. They have received vaccines, but I do generally go with vaccines that are more, what am I trying to say? That have been more well-tested, you know? So, it's just a simple worry that this is being politicized and the people who are invested in the vaccine being the solution, that's their solution and it's it, you know, which is just, that's not good science, really.
I really think that it's kind of a little frightening to me that everyone's focused so much on a vaccine because one, not everyone can easily be vaccinated for an illness. And two, vaccines are, have a record of not always being feasible. For example, how long has the HIV epidemic been going on, pandemic, and we still don't have a vaccine for that, if we ever will? Right. There is a lot of evidence out there that suggests that a lot of things might not easily be vaccinatable. And right. if we cannot inoculate against these types of illnesses, then we need to find another way to deal with the problem. And I think that we would be better served to find treatments to help people that do get sick get better. Rather than try to stop people from getting infected in the first place, we should find a way to cure those who do get infected.
And I will say that is where I think slowly our medical science is improving in America, because obviously the death toll is dropping while the caseload is rising. So I think they are finding some ways to treat it. And I've heard some things that, but it's a process, right? It's not something that's going to happen overnight. So,
oh my God, no, I really think that people have this idea in their mind that we're going to be able to get on top of this like pandemic within a year, everything's going to go back to normal and it's all going to be a bad memory. And I think that's really optimistic, but I also think it's really naive.
And I also want to point out, I tried to maintain 6 feet from people generally in public even before this. And it's usually people who are more susceptible that break my 6 feet and come into my bubble.
Oh, well, man, like, let's be real here. I'm a bit of a shut-in myself, so I'm like a master at social distancing, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so basically, this is going to be something that's going to take a long time to really solve, if ever, and we might be staring down the reality that we're dealing with the new normal that's going to last for the rest of our lives, because this viral pandemic could very well become endemic and just stay and come back every year. And if that happens, and if we do not have a feasible vaccine because the immunity is not long enough, then we will probably have to reorganize the way our society works or find a way to deal with it. And knowing that that is the case, I'm just not sure what we can do in that situation. I really hope that a vaccine will work and that we do find ways to lower the negative effects of those who do get infected. But I'm greatly concerned because I don't know what we're going to be able to do here.
Well, I think part of it does start with living healthier. I will say I think our overall quality of health in America had been declining for a long time prior to this.
So. Oh, absolutely. And that's a worldwide problem. Of course, the food delivery apps, which have gone mainstream ever since this the lockdown started as well, are not really helping.
No, absolutely.
I mean, they call they call it the Quarren 15, but I guess I think for me it's more like the Quarren 30 at this point.
Yeah, I've been lucky. Like I said, you know, I still go to the parks, and because I have two small children, I practically have to. So
it keeps you active, yeah.
Yeah, but I've also been to the gym. We have a little gym in my apartment complex, so the exposure there is pretty low to go there. And you know, it's just. I've always been one that has been kind of exercise conscious. And again, you know, living obese or living with any other types of pre-existing conditions, some are unavoidable. If you absolutely do have immunity dysfunction, that's not your fault, you know, but a lot of them are choices. And that's part of what, I mean, even before this, you know, neurovirus ran around a lot, and I'll be honest with you, there are a couple of years that I'd be incapacitated for about 24 hours with neurovirus. You know, that happened probably, I'd say, on the regular every 2 years from when I finished college till last year. And I don't really know what to do about it. You know?
A couple of years ago, I got like a really bad, I at the time assumed it was a common cold, but in retrospect, I think it was the flu. Because I had aches and pains, a really, really bad stomach ache, a major migraine, really, really warm to the touch forehead. And it was basically the flu. And I was like bedridden for a couple of days. And I do not handle being sick well. Like when I have a common cold or when I have a flu, I break down and cry like a bitch. I can't take it. You know, I am very weak. But the point is, a couple of years ago, I had a really bad one, and it was a flu. And the flu itself has a general mortality rate of 1% of 1 in 1,000,
right,
which is 0.1%.
It's not nothing, yeah.
But I always thought it was nothing because, you know, I'm never scared of the flu. I never think that there's a chance I could die from it. And I think this whole pandemic has taught me that you actually can die from things like the common cold and the flu. It's rare, but it can happen. And these are things I never thought prior to this pandemic. It's like, oh, it's just the flu. Wait a couple days, it'll go away.
Well, and in America in particular, people see you don't, I guess you don't drive a lot in British Columbia because you live in the middle of Vancouver, but people never think about how often people die from car crashes here. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like that's
your
worse
odds
than the
of
flu.
And like, how about the fact that more people have died this year so far from things like heart disease or cancer than have died from the coronavirus?
Right. But no, nobody talks about that here.
But I really think that we're kind of, again, by focusing on the mortality figures, we're kind of missing the forest for the trees, though. I really think that there are a lot of other effects that this viral illness, COVID-19, does have that can very negatively impact people's health for the longer terms. I think those should be monitored and should be really carefully researched and figure out exactly what's causing them.
I would like more research into them because I will say one of our friends, of course, shared us an article from some nurse that had said it. And don't get me wrong, I'm not implying that just because it's a nurse that means there's no credibility. Absolutely not. But, you know, we got to be careful. The other thing that made me sort of mad about the way this is being handled is sort of the rush to make conclusions. And I understand why they're doing it. They're concerned. But it's almost like people, this may sound sort of crazy, but I've already said this before. It's almost like people can't handle the fact there are just some things beyond our control sometimes.
Well, no, I don't think that that's crazy at all. I think that's a fair assessment. Well, you know what I've been really watching a lot of YouTube videos on lately? That's not quite entirely related, but I'm going to bring it up because it's interesting and it shows man's hubris.
Right.
I've been watching a lot of videos on YouTube about the sinking of the Titanic, just because for some reason they've been recommended to me on YouTube. And it really kind of shocks me, like the message, which is humans think we're so much above nature, but we're not. And nature still controls us. And so when we built the ship and we called it unsinkable, it still sunk.
Right.
We were tempting nature. We were basically telling nature, I dare you. The problem is that I think we've lived so comfortably for so long, and we've gotten so used to how things like vaccines and modern medicine has managed to practically eliminate a lot of illnesses that pretty much no longer exist anymore. we've gotten used to this. And so we're no longer able to handle when we're no longer in control. And that's why this pandemic has led to a lot of people mentally not being able to handle it, because it's like, this is not supposed to happen in real life. This is movies. This is Hollywood. This isn't real life. It can't be.
And right, and that's where I sort of get upset with some of the people are talking about there that were really stringent vaccinators on it, right? Is because, you know, I've kind of been willing to accept that for a while. But other people are just like, oh, no, we're going to find the thing tomorrow that cures this. And I'm like, I don't know. You know?
I really hope that we will. And I do have faith that that humanity will prevail because, well, we're really good at finding our way out of a pinch in really, really crappy situations. So I have faith that we will, but it's a question of when that will be rather than if. I just think that the 12 to 18 month timeline that they've been talking about is really quick and unlikely to be the case. I think it's likely that the coronavirus that we have, the SARS-CoV-2, as they're calling it, and the COVID-19 disease that it causes.
The particular strain of it, yes.
I think this strain will wane over a couple years, kind of like how Spanish flu kind of died out on its own. Right. So I think that it will correct on its own. And I know that humanity will survive it and will probably come out in better shape than we were prior because we learned a lot from this. Mm-hmm. So I actually have a lot of faith in humanity and our ability to manage this. It's kind of similar with climate change. I'm not too worried about it because I have a lot of faith that humanity will find a way to deal with it when the problems become severe enough.
Well, I guess I should rephrase it. I don't think I'm willing to sort of accept that, you know, there's going to be a lot of speed bumps along the way. I don't believe in silver bullet solutions. I should put it that way. And, you know, like you said, it's probably going to be something that fades out over time just in general. But people who think that, like, tomorrow we're going to wake up and there's no cases or no deaths are just foolhardy.
It's going to fade away, but it's probably still going to exist in some way, shape, or form. It's just not going to be quite to the same degree. But it's a novel virus to this point. We still are learning a lot about it. There's a lot we still don't know. And since this is the case, there is reasons for caution and reasons for optimism at the same time. There hasn't really been a pandemic that has been caused by a coronavirus itself before, so other than like SARS and MERS, but those didn't really spread very far, nor did they kill very many people. This is the first coronavirus that has actually been relatively deadly that has spread very easily. And I think what worries me is a lot of people in particular, like say friends that I mentioned earlier, I'm not going to name them, oftentimes compare it to influenza, which is a completely different family of viruses that behaves entirely differently. Coronaviruses are actually very good at preventing the body from building immunity to them. That's why a lot of coronaviruses themselves actually are things that cause the common cold, because they're very hard to create an immunity to, because they generally to create a vaccine for, because the immunity does not last very long. You're looking at maybe a couple months to 6 months at best for, say, your typical strain of the common cold caused by a coronavirus. And so this is looking like it might be similar. Now, I have faith that may or may not be the case. There's a lot of chance that the data we have now might be wrong, and that there is a chance that the virus might actually be build up more immunity antibodies for a longer period of time than they have stated. But it is a coronavirus, which is not the same as influenza. So comparisons with the flu are kind of a little flawed.
Yeah, and then, of course, that good old darn data. So I won't spend too much time on it, but I have been quite troubled by the sort of complete contradictions in American data. And, you know, and I also want to just straight up say I don't believe any of the numbers in Brazil, China, or India at all.
I don't really trust their numbers either. Like, for example, in India, they've got 937,000 cases after today. But the problem is with India is that they, as a country, are very poor, very densely populated, and do not have the tools or the equipment to adequately measure the actual extent of the problem.
Right.
Furthermore, I don't trust Modi. The Prime Minister Modi, I do not trust him.
I wouldn't trust him either.
So, I definitely don't trust India. Honestly, look, I don't want to sound racist by saying this, so I'm going to be careful, but any of the numbers that come from developing countries, so Africa, India, Southeast Asia, like Indonesia or something, or like, I don't know, Central and South America, I have a lot of skepticism about their numbers because these countries do not have the tools and the means to do mass testing and to provide the type of healthcare that people in developed countries that we like what we live in are able to do. So I have a lot of skepticism about their numbers.
Well, and that being said, like I've said before, I already have found a 25% discrepancy in our death numbers, and we're a developed country. So, you know, I don't really know what to think of a developing country.
Well, it's because CDC does two different measurements. There's a provisional count, and then there's a, like, or a presumptive count or something. I don't know the exact term. The one that you use, is all the ones that are confirmed. And I believe that's like 113,000 deaths in the US, correct? I haven't looked at the CDC numbers in a while.
I think it went up a little. I think it's back up to 119 or something. But they do revise it, and that's why when I pull numbers from it and compare it to other numbers, I was trying to do like a month back or so, right?
The reason why they do that, though, is because those are the confirmed cases, whereas the death numbers that you find on the CDC's homepage are the presumptive numbers. So, for example, there is a presumptive 136,000 deaths, for example, where about 119,000 of those are confirmed, and the remainder are presumptive. So about 16,000 or so are presumptive. And the reason why the numbers have been going up in the confirmed tally is because a lot of those presumptive are being tested and they're finding that, yeah, they actually were confirmed to be coronavirus. So the question is which numbers you want to listen to. If you want to look at the data that only shows the 100% confirmed, then yeah, there's discrepancy in the data. But the reason why they've got higher numbers that include the presumptive is because the presumptives include people that had the symptoms of it before they died, but they have not had their tests confirmed yet. So
I will
some
say
of those
though,
might not actually be coronavirus. We don't know.
Right. Well, and that's where, like I said, I found that article where the Pennsylvania coroners removed 200 cases because of that, because they said they absolutely were not. And you know, again,
I think there was in New Jersey a month or two ago where they added 2,000 because right. They were ones that died before and were registered as unknown, but they did tests and they found out that they did die from coronavirus. So I think it's a mixture of two. There's both an undercount and an overcount happening at the same time. So the numbers, no one really knows what the real numbers are.
And so I guess that's why I sort of get annoyed with the media. You know, is because they just hype on these so much to justify so many things, right? And, you know, some things are justifiable, but a lot of things are not justifiable. And it's like, I don't know. I wouldn't focus on them if the media didn't. Honestly, I wouldn't, you know, but they do. And it's I don't know. It's just annoying, I guess, more than anything. Particularly like, okay, so for instance, they'll do an example and say, well, you know, there's this many cases per capita in Texas and per capita in Kentucky or in Florida, and therefore that's why I'm making this order as governor. Well, that's kind of ridiculous. You know, it shouldn't be so much based on something that, you know, again, we don't have a really good measure of. It'll take a few months for it to really totally be rectified, right? So,
yeah.
You shouldn't be doing that in the middle of the situation, in my opinion. But that's just my opinion.
I think I'm going to say one more thing here before we finish up our the podcast here. I'm just going to say that the media will oftentimes hype up the numbers, but there's not some kind of there's not a conspiracy behind it. The reason why the media does this is because the media makes money off ad revenue, and the more people that watch the news see more ads, they make more money. And articles that they post or that they cover that are more sensational get more eyeballs. So when they say, for example, talk about the new cases in the U.S., and they only talk about the cases and ignore how the deaths have still not spiked. When they do this, what they're really trying to do is they're trying to play to people's fears in order to convince people to watch their content so that they make more money. Like, it's not some kind of nefarious conspiracy that they're trying to justify their actions. The news just wants to make money, and that's the way that they find that the easiest way to make money.
Well, and I should point out, I recorded an episode with somebody else. I think it was like my 10th episode about the New World Order, right? And I said it's not that it's really a New World Order; it's that it's in World Order. So, you know, there's always going to be a group of elites, and there's always going to be a group of elite media that want more of your money, right?
So, oh, absolutely.
So it's not really. It's like you said. It's not really a conspiracy in the way that people are thinking about it, but the people should think about it with some caution, right? You know,
well, they should. Are you aware of the term manufacturing consent?
Yes, absolutely. I'm aware of that term.
Okay, good. Maybe I'll explain it to your viewers.
Explain it to the audience.
Don't know.
Yeah, go ahead.
So manufacturing consent is the idea that, that the media being owned by rich interests and elites generally use the media to spread an idea to the public at large who will view it, and it will use it as a way to manufacture their consent for ideas or beliefs or political ideologies. So, for example, with the coronavirus thing, you could make the argument that the media constantly pushing this narrative is manufacturing people's consent for the lockdown policies. I'm right. Not saying that's happening, and I'm not going to put my foot down and say for certain what is occurring. But what I will say is people can easily come to that conclusion based on what we know about how the media operates, how the filter operates, and how manufacturing consent works as a process. There is a great YouTube video on this that was done by Al Jazeera, which I know is not a trustworthy site, but they still did a great video on this anyway. And the video is still accurate to what Noam Chomsky wrote about in his book on manufacturing consent. So...
Right.
It's definitely worth looking it up. So if any of the viewers or listeners want to find that video, just Google manufacturing consent onto YouTube, and you can find a great video that explains the entire idea.
Well, yeah, and I should point out, you can also, the examples I generally use with people are the Iraq War and other things like that, you know, where for a while in the beginning, you know, there was like 70% approval here for that. But over time, of course, it fell. After people realized, you know, things. But
well,
yeah,
exactly. The media works great like that as a way to push people's ideas or positions on things to match a public consensus that the businesses want themselves. But the main thing that manufacturing consent has really done is a way to maximize profits for industry and companies. So, for example, since the news itself is generally a business that wants to make money, they're not going to report on many things that will jeopardize that. So a lot of independent journalism that is reporting or investigating some actual good things gets snuffed or snubbed out and gets ignored. And so they do not get any coverage because it's not profitable to the media company and those who buy into the stocks of the media company.
Or even better yet, you know, for instance, we were in, you saw this other group we were in, this rant I got in, and I cited Jimmy Dore, of course, right? And this person was like, well, I can't trust them. They're an internet comedian. And I'm like, well, you obviously don't follow them very closely because, you know, essentially what he does is investigative journalism to a degree, right?
And well, yeah, obviously. And I guess the thing with what was his name again?
Jimmy Dore. He
Jimmy
used
Dore.
To be on the Unturked, yeah. But he does his own thing now.
I could do a lot of criticizing of the Young Turks. I don't really like them as a news source, but that's just my personal opinion.
Right.
Jimmy Dore is a bit of an internet comedian and an online journalist with a leftist slant. So when I see a leftist attack him, when Jimmy Dore is a Bernie Sanders fan and strongly opposes the inequality situations that exist, I have to ask myself, do you even know who you're talking about?
Right.
Because I don't think you're criticizing the right people here. We're not talking about someone from like the Rebel Media or Breitbart here. We're talking about some guy that likes Bernie Sanders.
Right. And so I just point that out because it's not necessarily even a thing about whether or not sources are reliable or not. It's about you got to understand the agendas and what things are. And like you said, the statistics hype helps the media with ratings, and it helps, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, you know, and that's essentially what it is. And, you know, some of it is based in reality. There is an actual pandemic. It's not fake. You know,
I think there's a very interesting article I saw in a Canadian news company that did a great job of showing, ironically, mind you, because the point that they were trying to make was how bad the U.S. was versus Canada. And they took the Johns Hopkins map that showed dots for every single county in the U.S. and only the provinces in Canada. It says, hey, look how bad it is in America compared to Canada. And I'm just thinking, that is a horrible, horrible graphic.
One-tenth the population.
And it's a horrible graphic to represent it because Canada is not being measured by every county or regional districts. We're being measured by provinces only. So it makes Canada look artificially way better off than we are. Like, I'm not saying that Canada is not doing better than the U.S. on this. We are. But the map that was used as a way to explain this was very misleading. And it immediately triggered my warning signal of, wait, if you guys are lying through this type of statistics, can I trust anything else you say?
Right,
and this was the CBC too, and right. CBC is reliable for the vast majority of things. I trust them, but this time on this one issue, all it was doing was feeding into Canadian anti-Americanism, which is something that is very strong in this country.
And I'll point that out because that video we were talking about with Jimmy Dore, his point wasn't ambivalent. I think he's actually pro using masks, but he was pointing out how can you trust anything that Dr. Fauci says about it when he came on in TV and said that he lied about it, right? And that's the issue I have, right? Who do I trust? You know, I'm 31 years old and I've already seen all kinds of lying about the Iraq War. I've seen all kinds of lying about 9/11. I've seen all kinds of lying.
The one argument that could be made if Fauci did lie about that is the question to ask is the reason why and whether the reason itself was justifiable. For example,
Jimmy Dore asked that. Yeah, he did ask.
I do think that the lie was fairly justifiable because the generally speaking, the effectiveness of masks is not super effective, and it is more important at the time when you don't have enough to go around that those who work in the healthcare industry do need to get it first. So like Fauci's lie, although in retrospect comes off as very irresponsible, there was a logical, valid reason for it that was based in an actual logical fear that there wouldn't be enough to go around to the public health authorities and doctors and nurses, etc. Because when you have PPE equipment that's already not enough, and then you have people buying up all this PPE for themselves, all of a sudden you're going to have a serious problem where people working in the healthcare industry are not going to be able to have enough to protect them against you. So
yeah,
I can understand the argument, but I still think it was kind of the optics are really bad.
Well, and that's the thing. And you hit probably, and then I'll hopefully close up here in a bit, but I mean, you know, I got time right now. But the thing that really troubles me about the way I felt like the medical industry in this country acts in particular, I can't really speak to other countries, is they straight up will admit that they think that way and then will lie to you, where I don't think they realize how much mistrust they're creating doing that. Like, for instance, I was in the hospital with what I believe was neurovirus one time, and they were trying to get me tested for UC and Crohn's disease. And,
yeah.
You know, so now, you know, I don't, it's hard for me to trust the doctors, and I want to trust the doctors, but, you know, then this happened, right? And that's, you know, if you want people to act like adults, I think you do have to treat them like adults, as you were saying earlier.
It would have made more sense for instead of just to say that masks don't work, for instead to say that whether masks work or not is not confirmed yet, and it would be better for us to make sure that it, that they are available primarily for health officials before we recommend them to everyone else. If Fauci and other health officials had said that initially, I think people would be more willing and inclined to listen. Right. I generally think people are not bad, and I think most people generally want what's best for themselves, their friends, their communities, and their cities, so that when they are told to do things based on recommended and based on health guidelines, if they're told to do it, but they're not being told like an angry parent, most people will listen. Because right. most people generally do want to make sure that their friends, family, etc. are healthy, safe, and are not sick. Mm-hmm. Because generally speaking, I believe that people are generally good, not bad. And we're generally communitarian and not greedy. And so when it comes to the safety and security of our friends, family, and neighbors, we do care. We just don't like being lied to or demanded to with threats. And that's where the U.S. really messed up on this. And I think that's where I'm going to leave it off on here.
Actually, that was a great summary statement I was about to say. So, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I don't believe you should threaten people. And, you know, if the science is really clear cut on something, it will shine through. And hopefully we will eventually get this pandemic under control, but, you know, don't have unrealistic expectations about silver bullet solutions. And don't completely ruin an economy either.
Don't be naively optimistic, but don't be extremely pessimistic either. Be realistic and be mindful that we may or may not get through this. And if we do get through this, wonderful. And it'll be great to see everyone on the other side when we're finally through with this. But if we don't get through with this and we have to change our society, just be mindful that might be something we have to do.
All right. And thanks for coming on, Luke. And we'll do this again sometime.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. This has been a great conversation. I think we've said a lot.
All righty. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Check out the Know Your Place podcast on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/knowyourplacepodcast, all one word, or on Facebook at facebook.com/knowyourplacepodcast, all one word. And we will be coming soon to YouTube and iTunes, and maybe another social media platform near you. Special thanks to my wife, Sarah, and Jay Graff for the riff.